First of all, this is an interview with Louis Lubka in Fargo, North Dakota, and it is June 28th or
12th. Well, I was born in New York City. I had no choice in the matter. I did not pick my parents. I did not pick my mother tongue. I did not pick the color of my skin. I did not pick my gender. It was all given. My parents were progressive people, community activists, and I learned from them about becoming involved in society and not being a bystander or an onlooker, but being a participant. When I was about 6 years old, I got to realize I was born in 26. Millions of people out of work. There was hunger. One night, my mother didn't come home, and I asked my dad, where's my mother? And he said, she was arrested. She's in jail because they were protesting conditions. And millions of people were on the move. And so that was my background, you might say. And then I went through the public schools of New York. For those that know New York, I graduated from Stuyvesant High School, which was a technical scientific school, and I went on to Syracuse University. I was one of the youngest ever to arrive there. I graduated high school, and I was 15, and then I turned 16, and was a freshman at Syracuse. And after 2 years there, I received a notice from my neighbors, the draft board, saying I was drafted and a report for induction to the U.S. Army. And I did. I reported. I was inducted and sent to Fort Dix, New Jersey, where I got my uniform and other things. And I was put on a troop train because we didn't know where we were going. We watched the stations, trying to figure out, and we ended up in Georgia, we ended up in Florida, a place called Camp Blanding, Florida, where I got my basic training as a rifleman, and I did all the training, and it was 17 weeks of tough training. Learned to use weapons and that kind of thing. Tried to make a soldier out of me. Well, they never did. I was a civilian in uniform throughout my Army career. I never was a true soldier, although I obeyed orders and did what I was supposed to do. One day, there was a Lieutenant Schaefer. He gave me an order. And I said, this is stupid. And he said, it's an order. If you don't do it, you can be shot, you can be in prison. I said, yes, sir, and I did what I was ordered to do. 3 days later, we passed, and he said, Lubka, you were right, it was stupid. But you wouldn't find many officers that would admit. Long story short, as my training was ending as a infantryman, a group came along from the airborne, and they were looking for volunteers to be parachutists. And I said to myself, maybe this is the outfit I need to be in, because it was getting toward the end of the war, and there were a lot of people that were scraping the bottom of the barrel. And I said, if I'm going to serve, I want to serve with guys that, you know, had a lot going for them. So then they shipped me to Fort Benning, Georgia, where there was a place called the Parachute School. And I qualified as a parachute. I made five jumps out of perfectly good planes. And that was my qualify as a parachutist, five jumps. And then you became you got on what they call jump status, which means you got a bonus every month for being a parachutist. And we train, and one of my more, shall we say, some people would say exciting, some people would say dangerous. We parachuted onto an island called Dog Island, which was in the Gulf of Mexico. And of course, they set up these exercises. We were engaging the 999th Imperial Japanese Marines that were supposedly dug in on the island. I parachuted out of my plane and looked down, and all I could see was water. And it was a strong wind. Well, we had certain measures where you could do small things to control the parachute. And I monkeyed around with it, managed to land in about 3 feet of water on the shore of the island, Dog Island. We lost about 12 guys who drowned. I remember how we, when we jumped, we had all this equipment on us, strapped, including what they call a Mae West, which was a life jacket. And I was trying to reach for my Mae West, and there was so much gear, I couldn't even find the strings to pull to inflate the Mae West. So I landed in about 3 feet of water, up to my chest, crawled onto the shore, and we tried to reassemble. And there was eight or nine of my group that were drowned. And the funny part is I had written my parents about that exercise. They saw in the New York Times, 9 drowned in exercise, and they didn't know if I was one of them, but I managed to get a message back to them that I was okay. Anyway, the war was ending, and frankly, I was very happy about it. I remember toward the end of my service, we were called to an assembly of the troops of my company. We lined up in formation, and the lieutenant said, "I have some terrible news. Our commander-in-chief has died." And that was Franklin D. Roosevelt, who we all loved, and it was terrible. But anyway, we went on, and eventually, it was time to get out. And I was eager to get back to school, and there was a Sergeant Doody, I'll never forget him, D-O-O-D-Y, and he said, "Luca, the Army has great hopes for your future. We want to send you to Warrant Officers School. We're going to do this and that to you." I said, "Look, I just want to go home. I want to go back to college. I want my discharge papers. Let me go." And he haggled around with me and tried to convince me to stay in the Army. He said, "Look, the Army's giving you a home, shoes, a bed, 3 meals a day." I said, "Look, I mean, he kept trying to get me to sign up, and I kept telling him no. And finally, I remember, I finally told him, "Look," I said, "Sergeant, I'll be picking shit with the chickens before I stay in this Army. Just give me my discharge papers. I want to go home. I want to go back to college." And so finally he agreed. I had my discharge papers. I got on a train, had to change trains in Washington, D.C., go back to New York. And I passed a lieutenant. And he said, "Soldier, you didn't salute me." And I said, "Well, I'm out of the Army now." He said, let's see your discharge papers. I showed it to him. He said, you're still under Army jurisdiction for 24, 48 hours from your discharge. I said, yes, sir, and I saluted him. And I got back home. 6 months later, I was on the campus of Syracuse University, and an ROTC captain was coming down the road, down the sidewalk. And I jumped into the bushes so I wouldn't have to salute him. And after I got in the bushes, I realized, I said, I don't have to worry about this. I'm out of the Army. And so it took me a long time to get over the brainwashing that I'd had in the military for 2 years. Anyway, that essentially is the brief and not very adventurous story of my military service. I did make 12 jumps. Each jump was risking your life. And I did all the training. They trained me as a demolitions expert and qualified on all the guns, which of course has served me well, because when I was involved in the civil rights movement in the South, and we were doing some civil rights activities, the racists shot at us, and we shot back. So my gun experience was useful. And that's a brief overview of the whole situation. Oh, and I might say that those 2 years of service to my country, I wasn't subject to hostile gunfire. I never even left the States. When I got discharged, waiting for me was the GI Bill, which was the best thing that ever happened to me and to millions of other servicemen that came home, servicewomen. They paid for my entire college education, tuition, books, lab equipment, and a living stipend. So prior to my first 2 years at college, I worked in the dining services at the U, and I did all kinds of menial work to support myself, to pay for school. But the last 2 years was covered by Uncle Sam, who took care of us. And I have a small service-connected disability, and I will say that the VA has been taking care of me here in Fargo. I get all my prescriptions, $8 a prescription, even though one little thing I take once a month, it's something for bone health, costs $119, and I get it for $8. So I would say that the Army, the government, have taken good care of me since I was discharged. Questions?
I have lots of questions, if that's okay. How are we doing time-wise?
A quarter after one. We can go till 10 to 2, let's say.
Okay. Tell me, so when you were growing up, it sounds like you're... Well, tell me a little bit about your activism of your parents, because I'm quite curious about that.
Well, my parents were very unusual and wonderful people. They were vegetarian. I didn't eat my first piece of meat until I was 12. And I can give you a story on that, but I won't bother now. They were pacifist. They didn't believe in war, killing. They were nudist, which was fun to me as a kid growing up. And they were socialists. So I had a real, shall we say, alternate view of the world through my parents. And they were wonderful people. They spoke languages, and I picked up some of my language skills from them.
What languages do they speak?
Well, my mother was Russian, so she spoke Russian and English and French. My father was Polish. He spoke Polish, and he spoke a beautiful German, which I picked up a lot from him. And And he spoke Russian, too. So,
And was your father's family a German Russian or from Germany?
From Poland.
From Poland.
From a place called Łódź. L-O-D-Z, Łódź, which was one of the later industrial towns of Poland. They had the textile industry grew up there. The town was built after the railroad system was laid out, so they had to run a spur into Łódź. And in Poland, I'm called as Łodzi, meaning from Łódź.
And so was that part of the territory that went back and forth between Germany and the First World War, or how did your father learn German?
He was interned and captured somehow. He was in the Polish Army, brought to Germany as a prisoner, and he was there for a couple of years, and he picked up German.
Oh my gosh, so your father was in World War I then?
Yes.
Did he talk about his World War I experience at all?
No, he was interned. He was just a prisoner. He worked, I don't know, we didn't talk much about it. You know, you wish your parents were alive so you could ask 1,000 questions that you never thought of while, you know, they were alive.
Did you ever get a sense of whether he was treated well or not?
Well, he was treated okay. He never complained, so
okay.
I think if he had, he would have, you know.
Okay.
Yeah.
So where in New York City were you born or lived?
I was actually born in the Bronx.
Okay.
They say near the zoo.
Near the zoo?
Near the monkey house.
Near the monkey house, okay.
Yeah.
And so where I'm
curious... Then we moved to Manhattan when I was a little boy. And that's where I went to high school, all, you know, until I graduated. And then I went on to Syracuse University.
And where in the city in Manhattan did you live then?
What is called the Lower East Side, which is a melting pot of immigrants from all over the world. Now, my last trip there, I still have a few friends still alive from my youth. Most of them are dead. It was mainly Slavs, Polish, Russian, then Jews, then Puerto Ricans, and now it's Arab. So neighborhoods change. There's mosques there where there were Catholic churches, and it's quite changed. The basic street layout is there, but the people who live there have changed.
And are some of your friends from growing up still living in the same neighborhood?
Yes. Well, I have a cousin. She's still there where she always been. And other people, but most, you know, when you're pushing 85, most of your childhood friends are dead.
Yeah.
That's one of the downsides of being older.
Yeah, I'm sure that's very true.
Yeah, you lose your friends and they die.
Yeah, it must be difficult.
Well, that's the way it goes.
What year and, so what was your birthday and the year that you were born?
July 14th.
So how did you feel about joining the military, given your pacifist background?
Well, I was glad to be in because the country was at war. The Nazis were all over the place. The Japanese were invading island after island. And I wanted to participate. So I had mixed feelings. I was not a military mind. I have a cousin who just died recently who liked to kill people. He was a colonel of the Marines, lieutenant colonel of the Marines, and he enjoyed killing people. That was his, he was a killer. And he's dead now. He was a lieutenant colonel of the Marines. He won the Silver Star in Korea for killing Koreans. Then he went to Vietnam and was a big killer there. Some guy at NDSU approached me, a student, said, "Do you know Basil Luke, or Colonel Basil Luke, or something?" I said, "Yes, my cousin." He said, "We tried to frag him, fragging was an act of the military, of junior members of the military killing their officer when he was vicious and so forth. They dropped a grenade in his tent, but he was but he went to the toilet, and that's why he still lived. Anyway, he died this year.
So they tried to frag him.
Frag him. Well, you know, if an officer got too overbearing and too crazy, the men had their own code.
And so how would they cover it up?
Who knows who did it? It could have been an enemy, you know.
So it was hard to prove.
Hard to prove, yeah.
And so he was really, really vicious to his men, or?
Well, that's what I understand. I never served under him, so I don't know. But he cut himself off from the family. For 30 years, we had no contact with him because we didn't particularly like killers.
And did he, when you say he was a killer, and he enjoyed it, did he brag about his killing?
Yes.
Or how did you know that he liked killing?
Yes, I saw him many, many years ago when we still had contact, and he just bragged on all the killing he'd done.
C'est la vie, yes, okay. So what day were you inducted into the Army, approximately?
I think it was, I've got my discharge downstairs, about September 1st, 1944.
September?
And I stayed until about September 1946, 2 years.
Okay, so you were discharged right
after? August 1946, in time to go back to college at September of 46.
What did you study in Syracuse before you went to the war?
Well, I studied chemical engineering. Essentially, I went to the New York State College of Forestry, which is a wonderful school. The first year we all studied about forests, and the second year you had to make a choice in utilization of wood or taking care of forests. Forest entomology, forest pathology, the tree as tree. The second division was utilization, and you could go into what they call lumberyard management, or home construction, or pulp and paper manufacture. I went into pulp and paper manufacture, and that was basically chemical engineering. And I worked in some paper mills, and I worked in a paper mill in Wisconsin.
Where did you first start at?
The New York State College of Forestry at Syracuse University.
Oh, at Syracuse University.
It was one of the colleges. You know, they had a medical college, they had a law college, and I went to the College of Forestry.
Okay. And so you did that, and then...
I was drafted in my second... just about the end of my second year, and then came back 2 years later and finished.
And then when you finished, so you would have finished school then, let's see, and what year did you finish? In 48? Spring of 48? Or that would have been 45, 46, 46, 47?
I graduated in about 49.
49?
About then.
With your undergraduate degree?
Yeah.
And then you went to go work in Wisconsin?
No, 1 year, and then I decided I didn't know what I wanted, so I spent 10 years trying to figure out who I was and what I wanted to do. Traveled and did this and did that, got involved in the civil rights movement, and then I decided to get a master's, and I went to Georgia Tech. Or Masters of City Planning.
And when did you go to Georgia Tech?
Approximately 1950.
1950?
Approximately, yeah. I think I should do memoirs so I can get it all sorted out.